Hello, and welcome to this Radio Current Affairs Easter special. I'm Mark Colvin. On the international scene, Les Murray is widely recognised as a literary giant, not least in the way that every year his name gets included in the lists of potential Nobel Prize winners. But like the Irish poet Seamus Heaney, who did get the Nobel, Les Murray's poetry is deeply rooted in home soil. In his case, that's Bunya, inland from Taree on the New South Wales mid-north coast. And Les Murray's most recent volume is called On Bunya. I drove up there to talk to him.
Bunya's about 8 miles by 8 miles in size, and it spreads out because it radiates out beyond itself a bit. But they were mostly people visiting. You know, you were a lot of visitors in the old days because this was as with the Aborigines, so also with the white man, a lot of people passed through here on the way to somewhere much more important. And they'd stay at Johnny Murray's place overnight and sit around smoking.
Rick. So who was Johnny?
He was the first settler, he and his wife Bella.
And he was your great-great-grandfather or granduncle?
He was my great-grandfather. He was famous for his hospitality, and he was a generous man. It was the ruin of a few of his children, because one in particular, my grandfather, tried to be the generous figure that his father had been. Could never do it. It wasn't in his spirit. He wasn't a generous person. His father was. His father actually, in the end, lost the house in a card game. So somebody asked me the other day, so what did he do? Oh, I said, he went to one of his other houses, didn't he? But it was a wasteful way to live, and quite quickly the farms got smaller and smaller. And they realised they better stop doing that because they'd all have farms that were too small to survive on.
So you haven't lived here your whole life, No. But when you've been away, has some part of you always been here?
I've always felt at home here. I never felt that I slept the night at any other place that was home. You know, it was always, I'll be getting home soon, or if I just stay here till the rest of the year, I can go home at Christmas. I was never in any doubt as to where home was. And sometimes you see those people on television wandering away from where they'll never go back to, you know, somebody who'll never go back to their part of Syria, and you're terribly shy for, you know, sorry for them, because you know it's forever.
Yeah.
And their children won't understand them, and their grandchildren will understand them even less.
But when your ancestors came out in the 1840s, they must have known that it was forever as well. They were never going back to Scotland.
They fooled themselves, and they fooled themselves very energetically. They got very drunk on the idea of home and Scotland. And of course you knew that they knew they were never going back, but they did their damnedest to pretend. But then that faded after about two or three generations. That faded.
Yeah.
Nobody amongst them had ever been to Scotland, and it was all over. I think the first of my relays to go back to Scotland was my cousin Ray Murray, who went back 4 or 5 years before I first went back.
Could you read Caesar's Ghost?
A common old expression in its time, Caesar's Ghost. In the marginal dialect of this valley, again my sons grow up, tourists won't hear it. Others are elders. It was very bad news for the Kirk. Old men of the hard grey cloth, their freckled faces distended, squeezing grace through the four last things in a Sabbath bucket. I can tell you spare time childhood's force-fed this makes solid cheese, but often strangely veined. I'm thinking of aunts who had telescopes to spot pregnancies, inside wedlock or out. There is no life more global than a village. And my father's uncles, monsters of hospitality. Perhaps we should forget the 7-day-a-week tin bucket and the little children deadbeat at their desks. Caesar got up and milked, then he got his soldiers. But birds in their title work freeholds of straw, and the eagle his of sky. Dripstone for Caesar.
So the Kirk was what's called in Scotland they call it the Wee Free Kirk. They were Presbyterians. It's a very hard faith.
It is that. We never call it the Kirk either. People would, when they said the Kirk, they were joking. When they said the Church, they were not joking. And that was the kind of manner of them, you know. It was a religion that wasn't so much about morals, but about manners and severity.
But it didn't agree with you.
I didn't like it. It didn't go in for forgiving, as in any human community. There were things to forgive, and they were not always forgiven. And one of the worst was absolute destruction of my father and his father before him.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that there was a tree. Dad was a very good timber worker. He knew a lot more about timber than his father did. His father resented this fact, and his father wanted to be the champion of everything he put his hand to. And he thought he was a better timber worker, and he wasn't. And there was a certain tree he wanted to cut down, and Dad said, "No, you don't want that cut down. That's dangerous," he said. "It's full of white ants, and you put an axe into that, it'll fall all over you and kill you." You don't want to leave the bloody trees in the bush. You better leave this one in the bush, because it's not available. So Grandfather sneaked away and got his younger son, Archie, Dad's younger brother, to cut the tree down instead. Archie did. The tree fell to pieces, and big lumps of it fell all over him and killed him and smashed his brains out. From then on, there was a great feud between Dad and his father. You caused it. No, you bloody caused it. They would have rows. They would have screaming rows, and you'd hear them all over the district. They never mentioned what they were rowing about, but you knew. They were rowing about what was most on their mind. That was that they had killed their son, stroke brother, and each blamed the other.
And this was a small community. You're growing up in it. Yeah. You don't even go to high school over in Taree until you're 16. Is it a claustrophobic environment to grow up in?
No, not particularly. Most people were not pursued by demons like that. That was a particularly bad demon. It was a bad demon because it never stated its name. My grandfather kept Dad and Mum poor as revenge. He made sure that anything they proposed to do on the farm and improve it was vetoed. My mother found this very depressing. Now, whether it was her bad luck or what it was, I don't know, but she had a series of miscarriages, and the last of her miscarriages killed her. Now, Valerie and various people think that it wasn't a miscarriage at all, that it was eclampsia, you know, a disease of the womb, which is not necessarily a pregnancy. But she died when I was 12. Dad collapsed completely. He was useless for the next 5 or 6 years. And his father died just a bit after that. Ironically enough, Grandfather came and stayed with Dad the last few years of their lives, or of his grandfather's life, because none of the rest of the family, having got out of him what they wanted, each one got a farm, except Dad. He was not given a farm. Each one of them had got what he wanted, and Grandfather was unwelcome. Grandfather ended up here because it was the only place that was derelict enough to accept him.
So, there's a lot of darkness there, and then including the death of your mother, and that nothing, weighed on you very heavily for most of your life.
Nothing I can say on the matter was really in interest at all. You know, it was all... I was a child and wouldn't understand it, and it was never discussed with me. And that was a humiliation as well. I wasn't allowed to talk about my mother's death because, you don't understand.
Did you on some level think that you were to blame?
Yeah, I thought that since miscarriages were involved, it may well have been that I had a miscarriage and mother had no more live births. You know, it may well have been. I still haven't got rid of that idea. It may well have been my fault, but there's no way of proving it.
But
might as well not do it, but not torment yourself with it, because you're never going to know.
But it was at the heart of your depression that you had for a very long time.
I'm not sure of that. It was part of it. It was in there. I had plenty of things to be depressed about. I've done a book on them. It took me up to a few years ago to get rid of most of that stuff, and I'm not sure I'll ever be completely free of it. You know, I liked what Dad said when he was about to die. There, he had smoker's cancer, lung cancer. The doctor said, "Oh, you'll probably be right, Cecil. You'll be dead before it kills you. It's quite slow moving." But this did not happen. It stepped over to his brain, and suddenly it accelerated. And they said, "Oh, you got 3 to 6 months, Cecil, so you better make your preparations." And I asked Dad one day, I said, "Dad, have you forgiven all your enemies?" He had a few. He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Various ones that you had a quarrel with, you know, like your father particularly." He said, "I must have." "You must have?" "Yeah," he said, "I don't think about that now." I said, "You old fraud, you mean you can forgive somebody and not notice?" "It looks like it," he said. I thought, "Well, that's a lucky bugger that you got off the hook." I'll never get off the hook, but you got off the hook.
You'll never get off the hook.
No, I'll never get off the hook. I'll die thinking about it.
One of the things that growing up here has given you is a very, very close connection with nature. and an ability not only to put yourself in them, tell the stories of people, but also to tell the stories of animals. And I won't get you to read this whole poem, but just read a bit of The Cows on Killing Day for me.
Sure. The Cows on Killing Day. All me are standing on feed. The sky is shining. All me have just been milked. Teats all tingling still from that dry, toothless sucking by the chilly mouths that gasp loudly in, and never breathe out. All me standing on feed move the feed inside me. One me smells of needing the bull, that heavy urgent me, the back climber, who leaves me humped, straining, but light and peaceful again, with crystalline moving inside me. Standing on wet rock, being milked, assuages the calf sorrow in me. Now the me who needs mounts on me, hopping to signal the bull. The tractor comes trotting in its grumble. The heifer human bounces on top of it, and cud comes with the tractor. Big rolls of tight, dry feed. Lucerne, clovers, buttercup, grass. It's been bitten but never swallowed, yet is cud. She walks up over the tractor, and down it comes, roll on roll, and me following, eating it and dropping the good pats. The heifer human smells of needing the bull human and is angry. All me look nervously at her as she chases the dog me dream of horning dead, our enemy of the light loose tongue. Me a jam him in his squeals.
All me is not just a cow, but the cattle. Yeah. And so managed to sustain this right the way through the poem, that there's a kind of collective of all cattle.
Yeah, it is. That's what it is. Cattle are collective creatures. They live close to the ground, they eat the same food and they face the same way, and they communicate by their smell and their movements and their sounds and the whole thing. Each animal is an entity closely bound up to the others.
Well, that poem ends in this incredibly distressing way. The cows on killing day gives a clue to what it's about. It's about the death of these cows who've come to the end of their useful life. They say that the death is the central subject of poetry, or certainly one of them. How much has growing up around nature focused you on that endless cycle of life and death?
Oh, it does. It does. You know about it. Although, mind you, in that poem, only one of them is being killed. They're just killing the meat that they need. The others do what cattle do. Cattle, when they see a death of fellow cattle, they gather round and they roar and they stomp and circle around, and gradually they give up and wander off. It's as if they're holding a ceremony, you know, to say, come back from that death. The death doesn't go away, so they give up and wander off.
A lot of this book is about history. It's about your ancestors, the people who've populated this district.
Well, we didn't have very many people around here. You didn't have a competition of a large crowd. You got to know a small number of people rather well.
But a lot of it is about the past. Do you think it's a past which is passing? People talk about the depopulation of the rural areas. Is this one of them?
They don't talk about it. They don't talk about it much. Anyway, there is a class of people around here, these parts, which barely existed when I was a kid, and that was the people who came, stayed a little while and left. Now there's a lot more people who come and stay a little while and leave. We were more used to people staying their whole lives, and they didn't talk about these things much. They were quite likely to talk about their neighbours, and particularly if the story was funny, they'd delight in it and tell it many times over.
Well, there's a poem called The China Pear Trees, which is kind of about that long continuity. Give us a bit of that.
The China pear trees. The power of three China pear trees standing in their splintery timber bark on an open paddock. The selector's house that staked and watered them in Bible times, beside a shaded patch, proved deciduous. It went away in loads. But after 60 years of standing out, vanishing in autumn, blizzarding in spring, among the farmland sparse and giant furniture, after 60 crops gorged on from all directions, so that no windfalls fermenting shrank to lizard skin puree in the short gravel grass, the trees drew another house, electrified and steaming, but tin-roofed as before, for blazing clouds to creak over and with tiny nude frogs upright again on lamp-lit glass. In other words, these trees out here, which look a bit like ruins, for a long time, the house that was here before, which was built in the 1880s, had been taken away in 1914 and rebuilt about a mile up there. And there was no more house here for many decades. And then in 1975, we built a new house on the place. There'd been a gap, and now the life of humans around the houses had returned. What the man who owned this place used to do, he grew corn and sold it for fuel for horses and animals, mainly horses. He got 5 shillings a bushel for corn, which is a damn good price. He lived well. And then the motor car came along. It began to creep in around the edges. And by 1914, it was all over. He said, oh, we just go up and do something else. This is all over.
When you read that poem, and you didn't read the whole of it, I get an image in my mind like one of those speeded up films where there's a fixed camera and you see the pear trees growing and a house grows next to them and then the house is pulled down and then another house grows around them and it all happens just over the course of 2 pages.
Yeah.
That's what is in your mind.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of movies. Yeah. His name was Jim Murray. And his wife was Jane, and my father had a contempt mixed with ridicule for her, and he was terribly afraid on the day when he needed to go through the telephone system to reach the doctor to get the ambulance because Mum was bleeding to death. He was terrified that she would be blabbing the intimacies of the whole thing around the district on the telephone system.
This was in the old days of the party line.
Yeah. But strangely enough, she knew when to stop. She never told anybody. But he also didn't tell the doctor enough. He said to the doctor, oh, my wife's having a bad turn, a real bad turn. He didn't give the doctor any details. The doctor, therefore, being an idiot, wouldn't send the ambulance. My Aboriginal cousin, one of my Aboriginal cousins, Vicky Greaves, said years later, she said, Aboriginal people die of that sort of thing all the time. They don't quite know how to talk through the white authority figure. Death is often the result.
Is that one of the things that the idea of the subhuman redneck comes from?
Oh, yes. I've always known that I'm a subhuman redneck. We were told that early in life, just in little simple ways, various ways, like at school, and not the local school on the hillside, but one in town. To them, we were subhuman. They laughed openly at us.
Often described as one of the world's greatest poets, usually described as Australia's greatest living poet, and you still have that feeling of a subhuman redneck.
Oh, a subhuman redneck, of course I am.
Is that because of the bullying?
That, I suppose, partly, yeah. You know that deep down, the university English departments are never going to take me seriously because they're in the business of training kids to be members of the middle class. I was sent to university to become part of the middle class. I did not do it. I did something else. I became a poet. I've never been forgiven for it.
But that sounds extraordinarily resentful, given that people like the great writer Joseph Brodsky says he is quite simply the one by whom the language lives. And then somebody, John Timpani in the Philadelphia Inquirer, says, would somebody please, please give this guy the Nobel Prize?
Yeah, I don't believe any of it. I know where people know where they fit in the in society, and you can't move out of it. You can play games with it, which is what I do, but you can't overcome it or dismiss it. You are assigned to that part of society, and the fires of hell will not move you.
Does it surprise you that you are so well known on the world stage?
Yeah, I don't believe a word of it.
But I was listening to a BBC program, radio program, the other day, for instance, in which 3 serious cultural critics were reading your work for the first time. For one thing, I was very surprised they hadn't heard of you. Mm. And they were reading your book, Waiting for the Past. And they were unanimously just knocked out by it, completely blown away by it. They found it completely extraordinary. So, you know, you're not just an Australian phenomenon. You do translate.
Yeah, I seem to translate all right. Yeah. No, that's okay. None of that surprised me. I know I can do it, but it doesn't change anything.
But you are taught in universities.
Yeah, well, I mean, so are protozoans.
People don't study like they've studied protozoans. They put you on a pedestal, if anything.
I just don't. There's another Australian expression, everybody knows it. Getting up on your high horse, getting above yourself. And it's not a mistake I'd make.
So tell me, are you still writing poetry, and will you go on writing poetry till the very end?
Oh, yeah, might as well. I'm too old to retrain. Just getting started on the next book. I've no idea what it's called. They find their way. They tell you what you're doing while you're doing it.
And will you be the rest of your life here in Bunya?
Might as well. Keeps me out of mischief. They're a bit of a curse. The jet fighters, they play around here, ducking in and out of the hills, you know.
And how do you think you'll be remembered?
Briefly. I might be remembered for a while because I don't think it particularly takes much away from anybody else. I'm not a rival to other kinds of fame. I can be left out there where I'm doing no harm. I've written things that people can read or not, and they won't die of it.
They won't die of it, but what will they get out of it? What do you think is the point of poetry, if you like?
A few of them might think thoughts that they'd never thought before. Right now, for example, this year was the year we celebrated, and that's the word, Gallipoli. Now, I abominate Gallipoli. I think it was a curse and a mass murder from one end to the other. It should never have happened. We should never have gone to the First World War. We should have stayed right out of it. And what do you do with all those people in a country who are of both nationalities, like all those Australians who happen to have German surnames, who went to the First World War? They hadn't thought it through. I wouldn't have gone. And Australia was sensible enough, the only country in the British Empire to have the good sense and decency to have voluntary military service. You didn't have to go. The Murrays of Bunya, every one of them stayed out of it. I think they probably had been soldiers enough times in Scotland, either fighting against the English or for them, to realise that there was not much reward in it, particularly for poor people. Might as well be sensible and avoid the gunshot and stay out of it.
You still write on a typewriter, a longhand and typewriter. In the internet age, will people still read poetry?
Would that I could. Yes, they will. Would that I could, because my bloody typewriter, I can't get a decent typewriter with a ribbon that'll work, and I'm trying to copy things out with a computer.
Yeah.
I hate the bloody things. And my natural preference would be to write with a biro, but no professional magazine will take your work unless it's typed. The privacy of typewriters. I'm an old book troglodyte, one who composes on paper and types up the result as many times as need be. The computer scares me, its crashes and codes, its links with spies and gunshot, its text that looks pre-published. I fear a carriage that doesn't move or ding, no inky marching hammers leaping up and subsiding. I trust the spoor of botch, whiteouts where thought deepened, wise freedom from spell check, sheets to sell the National Library.
I love the spoor of botch and then the joke at the end about how you can make some money out of the manuscript.
I'll have to pay them credit. The National Library has paid me a lot of money over the years for pieces of paper, manuscripts. Yeah, Kevin Hart suggested that to me, I remember years ago, saying, yeah, but he said, keep every one of your copies, keep every one of your versions, because they're all worth money, and you're going to need it. In our trade, you need money from anywhere you can get it. Well, you were talking earlier about the survival of poetry. It raises interesting questions like, why is it, if poetry is so important, do we not get paid, or do we get paid a token amount when academics studying us are paid a great deal more?
You make more money, I think, out of public appearances than you do from book sales.
God, yes. And I'm getting a bit old for it now. I'm a bit afraid of the day when it's no longer on. You can't live on bits and pieces of reading tours.
The poet Les Murray speaking to me at his home at Bunya. This has been a Radio Current Affairs Easter special. I'm Mark Colvin. Thanks for joining us.